Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. If you're rejoining us, my name is Maggie Dawn, and you're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Folks, if you've listened to this program for more than a couple of episodes, you probably heard me refer back to my time in public service. One is a time of great privilege and just an absolute highlight of my career to serve the public in that way for so many years. But I talk about the dignity, I think, in many public servants and in what they sign up to do when it is being done at its best and with the good and true intentions, not for personal aggrandizement, not for accumulation of power and wealth, but genuinely to serve the public. I have been waiting to talk to my next guest for quite some time. He came to my radar, you all will remember, at the end of August, when the head of the CDC was, I don't know, ousted, forced out, quit because RFK is nuts. I don't even know how to explain this, but her name was Dr. Susan Meneses. She then ended up testifying before Congress about her grave concerns that politics is being put ahead of public health, that the public isn't getting good information, good science. That again, what is politically salient, what accumulates political power for the current administration is determining public health policy to all of our collective detriment. Her resignation, her ouster, again, don't know what to call it. As soon as word of that broke, by the way, it was communicated on social media first, three top leaders at the CDC immediately provided their resignations. One of them joins me today, and it is with great thanks and just an overwhelming sense of respect that I am joined by Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. Thank you so much for being here, Dimitri. I really appreciate your time and your public service.
Thanks, Maggie. Thanks so much for having me. And any show that starts with Stevie Nicks is a friend of mine. So thank you so much.
I love me some Stevie.
Yeah, you know, stand back.
She's a mood elevator. Absolutely. Before we get into the circumstances of your resignation, you know, many of our listeners know I was working at Milwaukee County when COVID hit. All through our public health response, we helped stand up one of the first publicly available, fully transparent data portals on transmission rates and hospital rates that broke things down, not by just zip codes, but demographics and age ranges. It's become a national model. I know how important good public health is to each individual person's health. So I wanted to start there with you. You have an incredibly august resume. I don't need to read it, but NYU School of Medicine, you've got a master's in public health from Harvard as well. You've done your residency at Beth Israel. You're a clinical infectious disease expert. You've helped with HIV prevention and response efforts in New York City and at the federal level. I could go on and on. Why should every single American want to be sure that public health is being driven in an apolitical, meaning separated from partisan politics, and in a scientific-backed, consensus-driven approach, which can be frustrating and slow, but this is how it's done. Why should every American, every Wisconsinite care about that?
Yeah, thanks, Maggie. So I think the first thing is to know, what does public health do? And I think one of the challenges is that when public health is doing its job really well, you don't know that it's doing its job. It's kind of the thing that underpins so much of what supports the health of people, whether it's clean water, making sure that vaccines are available, making sure that there's ways to prevent overdose. It just goes on and on what public health does. And, you know, I like to think of it kind of like the blood that is running through the blood vessels of the country's health system. So, you know, you don't see the blood all the time, but the blood is the thing that connects all of the organs and that also provides like the nutrients, like the science and you know, really the guidance that is so important to what happens every day. So one of the important things about public health is that although it does live in a political environment, which is just the nature of public health, it needs to live in a political environment. It tends to have a very clear firewall between the science and the politics, like a really clear border where the ideology, where, you know, politicians always have ideology, it's what they do, stays separate from the work that moves policy and that work that moves programs in the United States. So when that breaks down, what can happen can be very dangerous, where rather than leading with science, science can be cherry-picked, science can be suppressed, science can be ignored, and instead, the public health apparatus starts to look a bit more like a propaganda machine or even a weapon, which is actually what Dr. Menares, I think, cited in some of her some of the things that she said around her resignation, as did I, that definitely there was a move toward public health being weaponized as a mouthpiece.
Tell me about what Dr. Menares and what you, Dr. Daskalakis, mean by using it as a weapon. I've talked to many people who work in the public health space, and all of them come to it with this deep sense of duty, right, to serve the public, to help increase our health and safety, to reach as many people, to help them make the best decisions they can in consultation with their physicians. What does it mean when public health itself is turned into a weapon?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing some, very clear examples. So I'm going to go out into my prior space working in HIV, where there's been a concerted effort to limit the ability of public health to talk about certain populations because there is an ideological disagreement about the existence of those populations. And I think probably the best example are transgender folks. And so, literally what's happened is that because of this ideological political view, which is wrong, there's no politics in gender identity. Frankly, it is just what people are. When the decision is made to, let's say delete everything that has the word transgender or gender in it that exists in public health, a couple of things happen. So the first is that you lose a really important information to the public, whether they are of a transgender experience or not. And the second thing is that you start to lose visibility into populations. So if your surveillance systems, the things that sort of do what you did in Milwaukee, were able to say what was going on with COVID, all of that. If the surveillance systems are impacted by ideology where you're not able to measure a population anymore, that means that you can no longer identify disease in that population. And so it is prideful and incorrect to think that if you ignore one population, that won't have an impact on the entire community because the communities are interconnected. And so, that is one example, I think, of the weaponization of public health. I mean, the other part is this sort of strange confounding of diversity, equity, and inclusion with health equity. They're not the same thing. So, DEI, that's something that sort of lives more in the sort of political zone about, what you do from the perspective of hiring. Like, I think I'm going to leave that there for a second, but confounding it with health equity, which is the role of public health to try to make sure that everyone has a fair shot at the best health they can achieve, and saying you're not allowed to talk about health equity and all of the things about health equity have to be removed from your website and your materials is a weaponization of public health, because then public health is unable to do good. All it can do is harm because you're no longer focusing on a key piece of what we do, which is optimize everyone's health.
And there were a couple of things that you landed upon that I thought were incredibly important to tease out. One is the concept of cherry picking to match a view of reality. You can call it ideology. You can call it projection of a desire to see a world that is heteronormative, white, Christian, ethno-national, whatever it may be, but whatever you think the world should be. And denying reality to match that desired, albeit incorrect, perception of reality, which then in turn necessitates science outcomes, and I'm going to put those in quotation marks, that match that distortion of reality. That's not good science. And I wanted to connect that very briefly with this concept of cherry picking and trying to use an understanding in public health what might happen in a poor community, in a community with less access to preventative care, in the LGBTQIA community, in Black and Brown communities. Those communities that are at greatest risk in whatever public health issue we're talking about, they do not exist on an island on their own, despite the distorted reality that many might adopt. And what goes on in those communities we see everywhere. So even for folks that want to believe in the white ethno-nationalist, heteronormative, male-dominated, whatever it is, all of those communities end up showing us where all of us have our public health vulnerabilities. So I wondered if you could connect those a bit together for our listeners as well. The idea of cherry picking, this distorting of science, and this denial of folks in these other communities, and how that puts the folks that are distorting the reality at risk as well.
Yeah.
Sorry for the long question, but these are the things that come together.
It's great. And I think distortion is a really good word. And so I think when you sort of design the material that you're going to use to create policy to really be the evidence that leads to the foregone policy conclusion, it means that you really have to pick, you know, various things to be able to make the argument. And so that's frankly what the MO has been of RFK Jr., which is, you know, we're going to conclude that Tylenol causes autism. And so we're going to pick up one study that says that there may be an association with autism, but then also says that there's no causal link identified. And then we're going to put out social media, including from the acting CDC director, that makes the point that there's a reason not to use Tylenol, even though there is no science to back it up. And so, you know, that is the issue, that they're starting with a conclusion and then are retrofitting data to be able to support it. And frankly, that's one of the reasons that the three of us left CDC, because we found that people were trying to, you know, bring folks into CDC to look at data specifically to identify ways to retrofit to a conclusion. And, you know, in one stunning moment, you know, there was a debate about an ingredient in vaccines called thimerosal. A person who was frankly anti-vax historically came to present at the meeting where that was discussed. There was another document that was put up on the website that went deeply into the science of that ingredient, which, you know, debunked the claim that it was related with autism. And in the middle of the meeting, the secretary called and said, take that document down. That is cherry picking and suppressing science, which is not the way public health is supposed to be, and will result in bad outcomes for health.
For everybody.
Right. So I come from the HIV space, right? When you start to say that like diseases like only live within one geography or one population, you're going to make a big mistake. And so, you know, the beginning of the AIDS crisis was like, this is in gay men. And then that's not what happened. And that wasted a lot of time. And so we're going back into some weird time machine to say, like, let's pretend communities aren't connected.
It was also immoral.
It was also immoral.
And yes, we're going to continue this discussion with former CDC's head of infectious diseases, Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. We dig into public health. It matters to you, the public, every single one of us. Good science means better lives for us all. Stay with us. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody, and welcome if you're rejoining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. With me for the bulk of this hour is Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. He was the White House National MPOX Response Deputy Coordinator. He worked at the CDC. He was the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. And he was also the director of the Division of HIV Prevention. We're talking about public health and, frankly, the takeover of the nation, maybe the world's most preeminent public health department, the Department of Health and Human Services, under the Trump administration, and by extension, therefore, the CDC. Those are no longer public health agencies. They are political propaganda machines that, frankly, are promoting bad and bunk science to the detriment of every single community. And Dr. Daskalakis, when I read your resignation letter, which was a treatise and good for you, it brought tears to my eyes because I could feel the pain and frustration that you and your colleagues were experiencing. Wanted to just share a little bit of your letter and talk a little bit more deeply about what this means for just regular families that are struggling to figure out what's best for their kids or their family. You wrote this: I am unable to serve in an environment that treats CDC as a tool to generate policies and materials that do not reflect scientific reality and are designed to hurt. rather than to improve the public's health. And you reference the recent changes to the children's immunization schedule. By the way, I watched the 2 days of that vaccine panel's board. Shocking. As an economist, I was like, don't these people know that just picking their own personal experiences as a justification for policy is not public health? But I digress. You went on to write as well, I have never experienced such radical non-transparency, nor have I seen such unskilled manipulation of data to achieve a political end rather than the good of the American people. It is literally has turned the mission of the CDC and DHHS on its ear. Can you share some, I know we talked about response to the AIDS epidemic and what canary in the coal mine that was for all of us as Americans when it comes to public health issues. Could you give us a couple of examples and things that regular people who might not be immunologists or MDs can keep an eye out for when they're hearing RFK and other now what I'm going to call lackey non-public health experts running amok in the CDC talking about things like Tylenol or whatever it may be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem is going to be it's going to be hard to figure out what is real and what is manipulated. So I think that the right answer is, frankly, to take all of RFK Jr.'s health advice worth a grain of salt, or do what he said when he testified in Congress, which is don't take it from him at all.
Yeah, so don't listen to me at all. I'm not a good source of information.
He's right. He's not a good source of medical advice, and he should not be heeded. So I think that, you know, if you're doing it yourself, I think, you know, looking at what he's presenting and asking the question, like, where is this coming from? Are there any studies that support it? And what kind of study is it? Like, one of the things that they tend to do is they cherry pick parts of a study, but then don't actually fulfill what the investigator believes was the conclusion of the study. So I think that there's great examples that we've already had in vaccine where they said, you know, that as an example, that there was something associated, a bad outcome in pregnancy associated with COVID-19. I saw that reference, I pulled the reference, and the reference was that in the raw data, this was found, but then when it was adjusted for all of the confounders, so the things that can make you like confused about what the result is, there was no longer a signal. So what that is like the thing to look at, which is if you are interested in looking at the study, read the whole thing and see what the interpretation is of the people that did the study, because that'll be a really important piece. My experience had been that they literally say, you know, we're going to quote this raw data and not actually go the rest of the way. The other thing is, not every study is built the same, and this may be more insider trading. If someone is sort of presenting like one case of something interesting, that's not the solution. It's a question to really get scientists to do more research. And so if it is focused on one event or a small number of events, that may be something that needs to be additionally reviewed. And lastly, if it's about your health, talk to your clinician. Talk to your pharmacist, your doctor, your pediatrician, because one of the things that RFK Jr. is doing is trying to destabilize your relationship with your clinician by saying that they're not to be trusted or that they're being paid by pharma to do one thing or the other. I'm sure that most clinicians would be thrilled if they had any disclosures to make because yes, they would love to make more money given their worth, but most of them do not. And so I would say, talk to your doctor.
Yeah, it's and of course, then there's the making up of whole cloth, like conclusions that weren't ever really reached in research papers. That one has blown my mind, misrepresenting qualitative reviews for actual quantitative time series, very vigorous statistical analyses. It's beyond just confusing causation and correlation. It's just wholesale misrepresentation of where the scientific consensuses or even what an outlier case might represent. And I just want to emphasize this, Dr. Daskalakis. There are many, many, it is frequent that a clinician, a doctor, an immunologist will come across a case or set of cases that they can't explain, and they will publish that to ask the broader scientific and research community to look into this. They are not presenting a conclusion. And I would be so bold as to say that was what was happening with the Tylenol case that RFK keeps citing. It wasn't a conclusion. It was a, hey, I've seen
association.
This isn't good data because we weren't specifically tracking this, but somebody should probably take a look. It's not a conclusion. It was a question.
Indeed.
We're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Daskalakis, and we're going to turn the page after reviewing a wee bit more of his resignation letter about what do we do together to move forward? How do we return ourselves to a place of real scientific public health analysis and policy? Stay tuned. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back and welcome, one and all. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I've been so excited and I'm so humbled to be having this conversation with Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. He was head of infectious diseases for the CDC. He worked on the White House's Mpox response. He has worked in AIDS prevention and response. He is an expert on public health. Harvard and NYU educated. He has all the fancy degrees and credentials. And he was one of the three headline-making CDC officials who resigned in the wake of Dr. Susan Monterez being forced out of the CDC by know-nothing conspiracy theorist, has no business anywhere near public health, RFK Jr. In your resignation letter, and then I just want to close this thought with you, Dr. Dimitri, before we move on to like, hey, how do we make this better going forward? You also reference the fact, I think that the tactics of the current CDC and DHHS and the administration writ large are belie what their true intent is. Here's what I mean. They announce major policy via social media. That's a propaganda machine, not an administration that is concerned with crafting the best policy that will serve the vast majority of Americans in the most efficient and effective way. And you mentioned the fact that big policy announcements, and in fact, I believe you learned of Dr. Monterez's ouster via social media. This is not the way that healthy organizations operate, and it's certainly not the way that the world's foremost or previously foremost public health agency would announce policy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you're seeing is the hostile takeover of public health by someone who actually doesn't like it. And so that I think is the symptom. I mean, I'll give you examples. I think you talked about Dr. Monterez's ouster resignation. It seems like ouster is the right word that we learned really about on social media. But I'll give you another example, which is, and I think I cited in my letter, that the secretary decided to put out a decree that he was going to change the CDC immunization schedule for kids and pregnant people and for COVID-19. And, you know, first of all, no one at CDC knew about it. We weren't consulted, even though it was the schedule that exists at CDC. But more notably, it was announced on an X post in a video. And that video featured Dr. Makary from FDA and Dr. Bhattacharya from NIH, as well as RFK Jr. sort of in the middle, flanked by the two. When that video came out, it was the first time I or any leaders at CDC had seen it. So I reached out and said, hey, like, can you send us some paper? Something that we can see so we can sort of figure out how to implement this, because he's allowed to make decrees, by the way, red flag that he's making decrees about vaccines. But the response that I got was, yeah, just use the video and update the policy. And I'm like, I can't use a video to update a policy. And so they then, based on my request, they didn't send me the data for why they made the decision, but they sent me a piece of paper that was the decision memo around this. And guess what? It didn't match what he said on the video. So on the video, he said a COVID vaccine shouldn't be given to healthy kids or healthy pregnant women. And on the paper, it said it shouldn't be given to healthy kids or any pregnant women. That is not the same thing. So we then spent hours of that day trying to resolve on this bad policy decision, which, by the way, none of the data supports. This both the vaccine both protects pregnant people during their pregnancy and also provides antibodies to newborns, who are the highest rate of admissions for COVID-19. So literally hurting children because he decided to do this without sort of any of the backup data, dot, dot, dot. They walked it back at the last vaccine meeting because it's such a cruddy idea.
Yeah.
Right. I've worked in lots of places and I've had lots of styles, but never have I seen someone say, why don't you just look at the ex post video and figure it out? That's for the country, the US.
I'm never rendered speechless. I nearly am here. I will use the term baby killing. What? And I just to share with people, I'm not a doctor, right? But I sat in Zoom and Teams meetings for hours as COVID was happening with our states and our counties' foremost public health experts, immunization and immunology experts, the Medical College of Wisconsin and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, spending hours crafting in detail the sorts of policies that you're talking about to make sure that we were getting the state of the science as it was best and on a broad consensus basis known at the time, referencing daily the CDC's website. So you're describing this to me is, and then the discrepancy between the non-scientific just statement of policy in writing and the fact that the guy couldn't even read his own talking points correctly for these social media video posts is insane.
Yeah.
Because we talked about this last week with Dr. Craig Spencer, I did also want to tease out this portion of your resignation letter. And you also said this, and I think it's worthy of note, Dr. Deskalakis. You said this: I have always been first to challenge scientific and public health dogma in my career. And I was excited by the opportunity to do so again. I was optimistic that there would be an opportunity to brief the secretary, and you go on and on. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to address that before we talk about the eugenics for a moment, because you worked in AIDS response and there was a failure in it by some in public health and in immunology in failing to understand that disease. Science isn't perfect, and challenging whatever the consensus is and being sure that we're not in our own confirmation bias riddled brains engaging in things that may simply be a reflection of what has been before. I wanted to give you an opportunity to address your openness to challenging dogma, and that is actually a hallmark of folks that worked in the past at DHHS and CDC.
Yeah, no, this is the, and I think, first of all, Maggie, thanks for your service as a public servant as well. I think you're going to agree that one of the parts of a public servant's job that's fun is being the career person that anchors the thing, that anchors the mission. And then you'll have folks that rotate through because of, you know, elections. And your job is to figure out how to meld the work that you do into their mission so that, you know, it actually has you steering in the same direction and puts their brand and their stamp on the work that you're doing. That also magnifies the work and creates the political will that's then necessary to keep doing it, right? It's like one of the fun parts of being a public servant. There's a lot of fun parts. So,
yes.
So that's important to say. And so, you know, when, however, the ideology of the person you're dealing with is completely unhinged, it becomes impossible to meld the two. And so I think that that's sort of what we had been seeing. So like, you know, a person who likes the idea of dismantling sort of the vaccine infrastructure and the vaccine endeavor in the US that has saved trillions of dollars, over 1.2 million lives of children, millions, like tens of million illnesses, tens of million hospitalizations. it's really hard to meld it. And I think, you know, when RFK Jr. started at HHS, he gave a talk, and honestly, Maggie, it's burnt into my head that he said, you know, like, I have asked a lot of hard questions in my past and sometimes have come up with unpopular answers, and I will continue to ask hard questions, but I'm going to hold my previous answers lightly so that I can engage with experts. I never met the man, and I was the head of vaccines for CDC. Not once has he been briefed by anyone while I was there about any of the issues that he speaks so knowledgeably about. So the question everyone should ask is, where is he getting his information? And the answer is from a series of wellness grifters and people who have other beef, whether it is their own financial beef or other, to try to destabilize the vaccine infrastructure. So that's where we landed. And that's why there's a lot of passion in that letter, because people need to know that that's what's happening.
I'm jumping out of my chair because earlier this week I talked about the fact that when you have Donald Trump or Mike Johnson or whoever it is, and this has nothing to do with public health, but bear with me for just a moment. When you Sure. have them say in response to, why did you pardon the guy who your sons and your organization are in a $2 billion cryptocurrency grift? Well, why did you pardon that guy? And he goes, well, I don't know who he is. Well, who does? Who did make that recommendation? Who does know who he is? What is the angle? In other words, who around here knows what the hell is going on, if not you or RFK or whomever it is? And why are those decisions getting made? There is this bizarre sort of oscillation between collective institutional amnesia that happens in this administration, and then in the next breath, assertion of expertise on all things. It's very weird and disconcerting. Let me ask you this very briefly. You also wrote this: the intentional eroding of trust in low-risk vaccines, favoring natural infection and unproven remedies, will bring us to a pre-vaccine era where only the strong will survive and many, if not all, will suffer. I believe in nutrition and exercise. I believe in making our food supply healthier. And I also believe in using vaccines to prevent death and disability. Eugenics plays prominently in the rhetoric being generated and is derivative of a legacy that good medicine and science should continue to shun. Dr. Spencer talked with me about this last week at length. Expand a bit if you would, sir.
Yeah, I mean, vaccines are immunological equity. Like, you're giving people protection who are potentially more vulnerable. Like, so I think measles is the great example. You know, I think historically Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his minions have said measles not so bad, right? So because, you know, it used to be back in Hyannisport when people got measles, they did just fine, right? But that's not what happened down the street in other parts of Cape Cod and other parts of inner city Boston, where in fact, the people that were dying were people of color who had, and if you look at the data, whose parents were less well educated and had other social factors that made it more likely for them to die of measles. So a vaccine, what it in effect did was equalize that by actually providing protection so that we didn't have to do survival of the fittest. And so when I see that there is a desire to let folks go at it, good luck, and only the strong will survive, which is frankly something that he said out loud in other environments, you know, that to me is really let's only select for the people that we want to propagate the flock. And I'll tell you, there was an interview on another network where he was talking about bird flu, and he said, you know, we should just infect all of the birds with bird flu, have it burn through all the birds, and the ones that survive should be used to propagate the flock. In the next breath, someone said, Well, the president's looking really good. He's lost a lot of weight. And the guy literally says, RFK Jr. says, that's because of his superior genetics. Excuse me? That is eugenics. It is not even well veiled. Like, there is a desire to propagate the flock with people that are a certain type of human. And that is what we're seeing. And that is really what we need to call out as much as we can, because that is a dark future unless we stop it.
We want immunological equity.
That's right.
He is Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. We're going to leave it there. That is what we should be focused on: health equity, which means we all have a right to thrive, not just survive, and that being healthy and well is not just for those on the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport, not just for members of Congress with nearly free Cadillac healthcare. and physician visits on demand. For shame, but big for thanks for him for being here. Thank you so much, Dr. Daskalakis.
We'll come back,
and I will have my final thoughts on the day. Stay tuned. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're in our last segment of the day, today, Thursday. Some pretty big news. Milwaukee County, their board of supervisors earlier today approved spending $150,000. It's a small amount, but it will help for emergency food assistance for county residents. That's a good thing, right? You've got state governments, local governments, all sorts of nonprofits stepping up to fill this gap, this void that Donald Trump and the MAGA cohort in service of billionaires has created, right? And as we've been talking about this and as people's level of alarm and uncertainty continues to go up, I wanted to make what I think is a really important point about this. Last week, not one, but two federal courts told Donald Trump that what his own White House, what their legal counsel's conclusion was back in May, which was you can use contingency funds and there's a potential to transfer money from other appropriations to keep SNAP funded because congressional intent is clear, that indeed that's the correct legal interpretation. Two federal courts told him that last week. And so then Trump, of course, because he doesn't know what the hell's going on, created chaos with his tweet. No, we're not funding SNAP. And then Caroline Leavitt and his lawyers had to walk that back. Yes, we're going to fund it, but only partially. Everyone needs to understand that that choice was made by Donald Trump to only partially fund SNAP benefits. And that the result of that is not only just a partial benefit, but that by only allocating enough to partially fund this month's SNAP benefits, he knew, and his lawyers knew, because they told the court this, and he would have known when they decided how to respond to those court rulings over the weekend, that a partial funding would mean extraordinary administrative problems trying to calculate that and then release the correct amounts to SNAP recipients. These are complicated formulas. How many dependents do you have? How many kids? Are you disabled? It's not easy. So make no mistake, people. What Donald Trump did, what his decision was, in the face of two federal courts saying what your own White House general counsel said months ago is how you interpret the law about SNAP, he made a choice to keep people hungry. So anybody that is hearing my voice right now, and I guarantee you, you know people who are worried and or may already be experiencing food insecurity because of this choice. The delay in receiving SNAP benefits, there's only one person that is responsible for that, and his name is Donald Trump. Those were conscious choices made by Donald Trump to let Americans go hungry. So bravo to the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors and others that are stepping up to try to fill this gap. But the fault lies only at one man's feet. And it is an absolute abrogation of the most essential responsibility of government. And that is the health and safety and wellness of the people you serve. And let's be clear here. We do not serve Donald Trump. He serves us. And I'd like to ask you a second question. Many of us learned this if we were fortunate enough to go to university, if we had to take a philosophy class, we likely stumbled across a philosopher called John Rawls. He is most famous for what is termed the veil of ignorance, which asks people as a thought experiment to assume that you enter the world or that you exist in the world in a place, in a class, or with access or opportunities that are vastly different from where you actually are in reality. Assume that you are one of the people in this instance that receives SNAP benefits. And assume in this instance that your SNAP card has no money on it and that you have no food in the refrigerator, that you have no car, that you do not live on a transportation line, that you do not have family to help you, that you live in your home alone because you are sick and disabled. And you do not have food. I want you to think of yourself in that person's position right now. And I want you to ask yourself what the government should do if that is you. And remember that one man, Donald Trump, said, screw you. And again, this raises the question of what does public service and what do we demand of public servants? What does it look like? And for all of these evangelicals and Christians that claim to want to live a life like Christ, who go to church on Sundays, I missed the part where Christ was like, you know what we should do with those disabled people living alone that don't have food? We should make sure that they definitely don't have food. I forgot that part. And today, one of the longest serving public servants has announced her retirement, which she, in my opinion, should have done maybe a little earlier. But Nancy Pelosi, I stand on her shoulders and in her high heels. Every woman in politics does. The first female Speaker of the House of Representatives, considered to be the most powerful and most effective Speaker of the House of Representatives in American history by many, but certainly in modern American history. And what did she do? One of the things that she is most famous for, most remembered for, was when she stood in her 4 5-inch high heels for 8 hours and 7 minutes in February of 2018 during Donald Trump's first reign of terror in this country and defended Dreamers. She stood up for immigrants. I seem to remember reading a few things in the New Testament about what Jesus said about doing just that. She is also some of the images most indelibly imprinted in many of our minds, even if we don't know all of the power moves and leadership she showed in the House, was that she literally was the only person, a woman, petite of stature, that stood nose to nose across a conference table, squaring off against Donald Trump on behalf of working Americans. And of course, when she tore up the State of the Union, that was a good one too. Thank you for your service, Nancy Pelosi. Remember, I will stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together.